a brief window for engagement at the UN. Today, Tuesday, September 24th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama's speech at the UN opens the door to direct nuclear talks with Iran. But the president is also careful to keep expectations low, saying the roadblocks to an agreement may be too great.
He was, I think, trying to make a diplomatic push but not go too far at the same time. The cautious Obama, as always.
We'll also hear how body language and small gestures can derail diplomatic overtures. And later, an American energy company makes waves in Europe with a push to reverse a ban on fracking.
We are not used to a company that try to change the law like that. They push the government to do what they want to do.
Plus, Pablo Escobar's son tries to cash in on his dad's infamous name.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run, at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you set aside the highfalutin stage and just focus on the words spoken by leaders at the United Nations today, it could feel like a breath of fresh diplomatic air. The big news in President Obama's UN speech was his opening to direct nuclear talks with Iran. Or maybe it was the announcement later that, after all, there will be no meeting at the UN between Obama and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. The fresh air died down a little after that. Still, it's a heady moment after years in which Washington and Tehran barely talked to each other. The World's Matthew Bell listened carefully to President Obama's speech today and tells us what he heard.
Forget that highly anticipated pivot to Asia during Barack Obama's second term. Judging by his message at UN headquarters, it's on hold. This U.S. president's focus remains locked on one part of the globe.
The convulsions in the Middle East and North Africa have laid bare deep divisions within societies as an old order is upended and people grapple with what comes next.
The president spoke for about 45 minutes and spent nearly all of that time highlighting the threats from the Middle East. They hardly sounded new. Extremism, sectarian strife, and weapons of mass destruction, Obama said, present an especially urgent challenge in Syria for the United States and for the international community. The president said the evidence is overwhelming that the Assad regime used chemical weapons, and the world needs to act.
Now there must be a strong Security Council resolution to verify that the Assad regime is keeping its commitments. And there must be consequences if they fail to do so.
Obama said the United States is prepared to use all elements of its power, including military force, to secure its interests in the Middle East. But he emphasized two diplomatic efforts that will be top priorities in the near term. They are aimed at resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Iranian nuclear issue.
While these issues are not the cause of all the region's problems, they have been a major source of instability for far too long, and resolving them can help serve as a foundation for a broader peace.
The president said there's a long history of mistrust between the U.S. and Iran. This won't be overcome quickly, but he's made it clear in letters to Iran's supreme leader and newly elected president Hassan Rouhani that America wants to solve the nuclear standoff peacefully.
We are not seeking regime change, and we respect the right of the Iranian people to access peaceful nuclear energy.
The president said conciliatory words need to be followed by action, and he's asking Secretary of State John Kerry to pursue diplomacy with Iran. The same goes for the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Obama said both sides are now discussing the big issues. The time is ripe, he said, for the international community to get behind the pursuit of peace. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
President Obama's speech today broke some new ground, so says Pulitzer-winning journalist and Reuters columnist David Rode.
I thought it was one of the clearest statements I've heard from Obama on what America's interests are in the Middle East. This is a huge issue to Americans. Overwhelmingly, the American public wants out. They want nothing to do with the region. But Obama was very clear. He listed four things that we are going to pursue in the Middle East that are in our strategic interests. He talked about protecting our allies. Clearly, that was a reference to Israel. He talked about that the U.S. will guarantee and ensure the free flow of energy. That's oil supplies. He talked about dismantling terrorist networks, which there is a threat, and I think many Americans would agree with that. And then he very specifically said, we will not tolerate the development of weapons of mass destruction. And he has resisted and his aides have resisted when I've interviewed them talking about an Obama doctrine. But those sort of four areas are the clearest things I've heard from him about, you know, what we will try to do in the region, what we're, why we need to engage with it, and what we're trying to achieve. And I think that's a, it's a good step forward that he actually listed such clear areas.
I mean, it was Iran pretty much at center stage for the big part of the speech. He said that when it comes to the prospect for a better U.S.-Iran relationship, the diplomatic path must be tested. We have heard that before. What was new or nuanced in his comments today?
What he said was that he was going to, you know, order Kerry to have meetings with the Iranian foreign minister who's going to spend the whole week in New York. And he kind of moved away from the Israelis a bit. He talked about respecting the right of the Iranian people to want to pursue peaceful nuclear power. And the Israelis have pushed a harder line, some Israelis, for all nuclear power to be stripped away from Iran, that it to have no program whatsoever. So he was, I think, trying to make a diplomatic push but not go too far at the same time. The cautious Obama, as always.
Now, you've noted that President Hassan Rouhani will be kind of the undisputed diplomatic rock star at the UN General Assembly. Has that put pressure on President Obama to make something happen here?
It has. And, you know, this new signs from Iran, it's a very receptive message to the world, which is sort of, you know, has bought into the view of the United States as warmongering, as resorting to military force. And Obama, you know, was trying to overcome that today. And we'll see if he succeeds.
Do you feel that if Iran serves the ball, the U.S., does it feel right now after his comments that they'll return the ball?
I think so. The question is, when do you dial back the sanctions? And the key here, again, is domestic politics in the U.S. These are congressionally mandated sanctions. It will require a vote in Congress to ease these sanctions. And already he's being attacked by Democrats and Republicans saying we can't ease the sanctions until there's a really comprehensive, verifiable agreement. We've seen this talk before from Iran. So he's really going to have to pull a very detailed agreement out of a hat here, or he's going to have a very hard time getting Congress to move.
In summarizing today, President Obama said that the danger isn't an America that is too eager to meddle. He made a reference to America's role in the world.
The danger for the world is not an America that is too eager to immerse itself in the affairs of other countries or to take on every problem in the region as its own. The danger for the world is that the United States, after a decade of war, rightly concerned about issues back home, aware of the hostility that our engagement in the region has engendered throughout the Muslim world, may disengage, creating a vacuum of leadership that no other nation is ready to fill.
So, David Rode, how is that message likely to be heard by other nations at the UN and around the world?
I think they'll be skeptical. Obama was sort of trying to thread a needle. One of the most interesting passages, I thought, in the speech was when he talked about Egypt. And he talked about that our approach to Egypt reflects a larger point. The United States will at times work with governments that do not meet the highest international expectations. He's referring to the crushing of the Muslim Brotherhood there, tremendous press restrictions and others. But then he added, but who work with us on our core interests. A lot of people see that as hypocrisy. You're either sort of pro-democracy and human rights or you're not. You know, in other parts of the speech, he talked about upholding those ideals. And I don't know if he'll, you know, will he be able to thread that needle in terms of global public opinion?
Assuming as well that he was also addressing the Iranians on that one, work with us on our core values, core interests.
Yes, that's a great point. He said our goal in Iran is not regime change, yet he's saying, you know, the goal around the world is to promote democracy, that democracy leads to stability and economic growth. That was, I think, the positive of the speech was that it was so broad in this effort to talk about the United States' priorities in the Middle East and the world, and to be kind of honest about where the U.S. is more, let's say, pragmatic and turning a blind eye in some cases.
Let me put on Iran's hat for a moment. Remind us why the U.S. feels it's in a position to dictate to Iran not to enrich uranium, but the U.S. doesn't take the same advice from anyone. In other words, why does the U.S. get nuclear bombs, but Iran can't?
That's, you know, clearly the argument from the more conservative groups there. I think Rouhani's very vulnerable as time goes by. He has sort of political capital from his election win, and that's exactly the argument the Revolutionary Guard and others are going to use to undermine Rouhani. Some American nonproliferation experts think that Rouhani and Zarif, the foreign minister, have concluded it is not in Iran's strategic interest to get nuclear weapons, that doing so will simply lead the Saudis to mobilize very aggressively to counter them. The West will mobilize as well. And really, it'll turn European public opinion. And I think the Iranians are sort of hoping the Europeans will be more willing to compromise than the U.S. will be.
Finally, David, how does Syria fit into all the rest of this stuff? Iran, the Mideast that he talked about.
For Obama, I think he's hoping that, you know, a breakthrough with Iran on its nuclear program could lead to Iranian cooperation in Syria. That in a best-case scenario, both Russia and Iran pressure Assad to step aside and you have a diplomatic solution. These are huge steps, and just getting this agreement to be carried out in terms of chemical weapons is a real question. Putin could be playing a long game. Assad does not need his chemical weapons to crush the rebels and the Iranians, and Putin could just simply carry out the chemical agreement but continue to let Assad crush his people with conventional weapons.
David, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That was David Rode, a columnist with Reuters. His latest book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. As we said earlier, Presidents Obama and Rouhani won't get together in New York after all, but it doesn't mean their representatives won't meet. The World's language editor Patrick Cox reports now on the language and gestures that can make such meetings successful.
Relations between the U.S. and Iran have been so bad for so long that there may now be an understandable urge to make up for lost time and get right down to business. Not a good idea, says veteran British diplomat Sherrod Cooper Coles.
Handling any meeting with the Iranians after a period of deep chill is, first of all, to avoid the temptation for Westerners to cut straight to the chase. It's very important to spend time on what are much more than opening courtesies.
We in the West may think of them as courtesies, but they can make all the difference, says Cooper Coles. It would be important to display a knowledge of Iranian history and civilization, but watch out for the little gaffes.
Like calling the Gulf the Arabian Gulf.
It's also not a good idea to overpraise, especially in public. In 1977, then-President Jimmy Carter went to Tehran. At a dinner with the leader of Iran, the Shah, Carter raised a glass to his host and then raised his rhetorical glass even higher.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world. This is a great tribute to you, Your Majesty, and to the respect and the admiration and love which your people give to you.
A few days later, street protests began in Iran, leading eventually to the revolution and decades of enmity with the United States. There are, though, plenty of skillful ways to send a message in a diplomatic setting.
I remember in the White House in 93, we'd agreed to have Yasser Arafat come to the White House.
This is Nancy Soderbergh, a diplomat with the Clinton administration. For Arafat, it was a big coup to get himself invited to the president's home. But there were limits. He wasn't allowed to bring his pistol, which he took everywhere with him. And then there was the hugging. Yasser Arafat was a big hugger, and it just wouldn't do to have him photographed hugging the president of the United States.
Right before the meeting, President Clinton's getting taught by his aides this jiu-jitsu move where if you grabbed Arafat's elbow, pushed your hip out, there was no way he could hug him. And that's exactly what Clinton did to avoid a picture being hugged.
Arafat eventually did get his man 7 years later. He and Clinton were finally captured, locked in embrace, but on neutral territory, Switzerland. Not that you'd expect quite such warm body language between Obama and Rouhani this week. One step at a time. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
Later on the program, we go to Nairobi and hear how Al-Shabaab recruits its young militants. Here on The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Heads up, our geo-quiz today is quick and to the point. The topic is fracking, which could take us just about anywhere in the world. That's because a controversial method of extracting natural gas and oil from shale rock is popping up all over the place, or at least debates about it are. But what we're looking for today is a country where the debate seemed to be over and where the anti-frackers thought they'd won. A couple of years ago, this European country became the first in the world to ban fracking, otherwise known as hydraulic fracturing, the process of injecting water, chemicals, and sand deep underground to essentially blast out shale gas and oil, was never to be used there. Well, never is a long time, as they say, and today this country's constitutional council, Le Conseil Constitutionnel, heard arguments in favor of reversing the ban. That last clue should have helped. Yep, the answer is France. Here's more from reporter Christopher Wirth in Paris.
Back when it was passed in 2011, many thought France's ban would be the final word on fracking here. Instead, shale gas, or gaz de schiste, is still a hot topic.
Arnaud Montebourg relance le débat sur le gaz de schiste, le ministre du...
The question in today's hearing in France's highest court is whether parts of the law that bans fracking are unconstitutional. The challenge comes from the American drilling company Schubach Energy.
Hello. You have reached Schubach Energy. We appreciate your call and invite you to leave a message.
I did, but Schubach never got back to me. In a nutshell, though, the company says the anti-fracking law isn't equally applied and wrongly stripped the company of exploration licenses it already held. Thomas Porcher, an energy economist in Paris and author of the book The Mirage of Shale Gas, says the case is highly unusual.
We are not used to a company that tried to change the law like that in France.
But in this instance, he says the oil and gas industry is lobbying hard against the law.
They push the government to do what they want to do.
If the court does strike down the ban, Porcher says the French government will most likely just pass another fracking law that would pass constitutional muster. Indeed, opposition to fracking would seem to be bipartisan here. The law was signed under former conservative president Nicolas Sarkozy. Current socialist president François Hollande came into office last year supporting the ban. And earlier this year, he stood by his commitment.
Très simplement, tant que je suis président, il n'y aura pas d'exploration du gaz de schiste en France.
As long as I am president, Hollande said, there will be no exploration of shale gas in France. But of course, it's not so simple. A growing chorus of lawmakers is questioning the ban. A recent parliamentary report said it should be relaxed. Even Hollande's own industry minister has come out in favor of some kind of shale gas and oil production. And Hollande's former ecology minister claims she was fired because of her strong opposition to the industry. Given the political division, anti-fracking campaigners believe oil and gas companies are already planning for the ban's demise. About 40 miles outside Paris, Isabelle Lavi drives through farmland she says could be prime real estate for fracking to a new drilling site.
See it? The light?
Yeah, I do see it. It's standing out over the fields.
The site is operated by another American company, the Hess Corporation. In a statement to The World, Hess said it's merely drilling a conventional exploration well. But Isabelle Lavi doesn't buy it.
This is a lie. If the law doesn't exist, this machine will be there, in the right place. So they will frack.
Hundreds have protested at the well site. But supporters say fracking would help France's sluggish economy.
This is a missed opportunity for the country, and at the end of the day, we cannot afford missing it.
Jean-Louis Chalansky is head of the French Union of Petroleum Industries. He wants the freedom to experiment with fracking to find out just how much shale gas and oil France has.
And hopefully the ban could be reversed, or at least that's what we want.
But energy economist Thomas Porcher says the industry still has to contend with French public opinion, which largely shares his caution towards fracking. A recent Harris poll showed less than a third of respondents support drilling for shale gas. Porcher says France learned a lesson nearly half a century ago when it plunged headlong into nuclear power.
We know that when we make a choice about energy, we have to live with the choice for a long time. That's why now we take a little bit time to go on fracking, because we don't want to regret it, as we regret, I think, the nuclear.
Porcher says France should focus instead on renewables and energy efficiency, an area where the country has lagged behind many European neighbors. France's Constitutional Council is due to rule on the ban on fracking next month. For The World, I'm Christopher Wirth, Paris.
Energy companies, don't you know, aren't the only ones with a controversial product. The family of the late Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar is trying to cash in on his famous, make that infamous name. It seems there's a market for Escobar-branded clothing. Pablo Escobar ruthlessly ran the powerful Medellin drug cartel, which smuggled tons of cocaine to the U.S. He and his henchmen were also responsible for thousands of deaths before Colombian security forces gunned Escobar down on a Medellin rooftop in 1993. That sordid history didn't stop his family, though, from trying recently to secure trademarks for Escobar's name, his image, and even his fingerprints. They were turned down. Maria Asaf is a Colombian-Canadian journalist covering this story for the National Post in Toronto. I spoke with her earlier today. What's going on here, Maria? What kind of things are Escobar's family actually selling?
Well, what they're actually selling, the Escobar's son, Sebastián Marroquín, which is his new name since he moved to Argentina, he's had an online shop since 2012, and he's been selling T-shirts, jeans. Some T-shirts have the face of Pablo Escobar. Some of them actually have his criminal record printed. And now he has, it looks like he's doing well because he has shops in Costa Rica, Mexico, the United States, a bunch of places, just not Colombia. He says he hasn't do it there out of respect for the victims. But the clothes is produced in Colombia because there's really good quality there.
Wait a minute. He's not doing this there out of respect for the victims. And yet he seems to be glorifying a man, his father, who was a cold-blooded killer. What's up with that?
Well, it's very contradictory because when I spoke to him, he said that he was doing this because he was trying to promote peace and he was trying to prevent people from repeating the mistakes that his father repeated. I don't know how this idea went around the world, but in Colombia, I can tell you that the public opinion hates the idea. The officials who denied the request said that it went against constitutional principles such as freedom, life, and all this stuff.
So, Sebastián Marroquín, why does he not use the Escobar name?
Well, I think it would be kind of obvious because if he used his name, I mean, that man is hated in
right.
Colombia. He would have been lynched.
Maria, you're originally from Colombia. How does this seem to you?
Well, to me, it's crazy. It's comparable. I mean, we chose the title to put online to the article like a brand named Hitler. I mean, I'm not comparing him to Hitler by any means, but this is what the official who was in charge of making the decision, that's what he said. He said, it's like you went to Germany and start a brand called Hitler. What I would compare it with is like you went to the United States and try to sell T-shirts with the face of Osama bin Laden. I mean, people would hate it. People hate it. Everyone's really offended. The vast majority of Colombians hate him. I mean,
what do you think would happen if I put on one of these Pablo Escobar T-shirts and walked down the streets of Bogota? What kind of reaction do you think I'd get?
I think people would throw paint on you.
Really?
Maybe I wouldn't go as far, but yeah, nobody would find it tasteful. Nobody would find it funny or interesting, or it would just be a negative reaction, I'm sure.
Journalist Maria Asaf at the National Post in Toronto, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, a community worker in Minneapolis and what a terrorist group like Al-Shabaab can offer young Somali-American recruits.
It's a sense of belonging, it's identity crisis, and there's this group that are reaching for them that's somehow indoctrinating them, telling them that you belong here.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. There's something about the terrorist attack on that shopping mall in Kenya that makes our world seem so small. Maybe it's a target, a mall like countless others we are so familiar with here in the U.S. Maybe it's the fact that of the more than 60 people killed, many of them came from countries all over the globe. And then there's this statement by Kenya's foreign minister. He said two or three of the attackers were Americans and another British. That's what we're going to focus on now, the sway some terror groups seem to have on people living in the U.S. and elsewhere in the West. Veteran BBC filmmaker Peter Taylor was in Kenya just days before the attack at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. He was working on a documentary about British connections to Al-Shabaab. That's a Somalia-based militant group that claimed responsibility. I asked Taylor what went through his mind the moment he heard about the attack.
I was shocked. We actually left Nairobi a few hours before the actual attack, and had the attack happened before we left, I would have obviously stayed on. I was surprised not at the fact that there was an attack, but it was an attack that had clearly been planned with considerable sophistication and preparation. Nobody saw it coming. There was no indication that such an attack was in the pipeline.
I mean, assuming that the attackers were and are card-carrying members of Al-Shabaab, I mean, you spoke to an Al-Shabaab recruiter when you were in Kenya, and you spoke with that person about how young men and some women are recruited. What did he tell you about the whole process and what type of recruits they're looking for?
They're looking for committed young Muslims. What's surprising is the age of many of the recruits who go through the pipeline. Many of these are of school age, 16, 17, and they're impressionable young, in this particular case, Kenyans who have nothing. The radical preachers, they are at the root of the radicalization and the pipeline and the recruiting. I also interviewed a couple of young Shabaab recruits who went through the pipeline. They found there was not what they'd been expecting. They didn't fight jihad. They were basically babysitters for the younger recruits. And to deter those who were thinking of leaving Al-Shabaab, these two young men, or one of them, was subjected to being forced to witness a public beheading of a young recruit who was trying to escape from Al-Shabaab's
clutches. And what was the point of forcing them to watch this beheading?
Pour décourager les autres, to as a warning, what would happen if they tried to leave. And these two young men miraculously managed to leave and went back to Nairobi, where they came from, but they feared for their lives. But I think the point of the illustration is to show how utterly ruthless Al-Shabaab is or can be, as illustrated by the brutality of the attack on the Westgate shopping center.
So the pool of possible recruits for Shabaab in East Africa, in Kenya, not just Somali transplants there, but Kenyans as well, born and bred?
The majority of recruits who go to join Al-Shabaab from Kenya are young Kenyans, but there are also recruits from the United States. I did a documentary in which I looked at the exodus of young Somalis from Minneapolis who were going to join Al-Shabaab. So whether they come from Minneapolis or America or the UK, the attraction of Al-Shabaab is an international attraction.
I think a lot of Americans would like to know today, when will Shabaab be bringing its war to affluent U.S. malls?
Well, I think that's one of the concerns. I know that's one of the concerns of the FBI. And I did an interview a couple of years ago when I was looking at recruitment from Minnesota. I interviewed one of the senior FBI agents involved in this area, and he was seriously worried about what is known in the jargon as blowback. In other words, people go to Somalia to, get trained and will return to undercover to America and carry out terrorist attacks there. That's what the concern is. What the Westgate siege illustrates more than anything else is the sophistication and determination of organizations linked to Al-Qaeda like Al-Shabaab.
BBC documentary filmmaker Peter Taylor, just back from Nairobi, Kenya, where he was making a documentary on the British connections to Al-Shabaab. Peter, thank you very much.
Okay, Marco, thanks.
Minneapolis-St. Paul, the Twin Cities, they're home to one of the largest Somali communities in the U.S., and law enforcement officials have been watching the Twin Cities closely for some time because in the past, Al-Shabaab has successfully recruited among the area's young Somali Americans. We're going to get a community perspective on this from Zuhur Ahmed. She's 28 years old and used to host a radio show for the Somali community in Minneapolis. First of all, Zuhur, what's been the conversation like when you speak to Somali Americans? How are people reacting?
Since the emerge of Al-Shabaab, I think the community kind of went through a great transformation, where right away there has been an immediate response from the community leaders denouncing and condemning the act of terror, making it clear to the world that Al-Shabaab does not represent the Somalis, and they don't have, you know, same values, or their values and missions are not aligned, then they have nothing to do with Somalis or the Muslim faith.
Does anyone in the Twin Cities in the Somali community think or maybe even wondered whether any of the attackers were from the Twin Cities?
There has been a speculations that the two of them were here because in previous attacks that were carried by Al-Shabaab, young Somalis that were left from Minnesota were involved. They were easily identified right away. So the fact that, you know, no one came and identified them or family members or, you know, friends and whatnot made me question if that's really true.
Right. I mean, as you say, that would be speculation, but it wouldn't be a stretch. I mean, you know some men who in the Twin Cities who were recruited and involved in a previous Shabab attack in Mogadishu in Somalia.
Yeah, I mean, I knew two of the men that were recruited who went back to fight with the Islamist or the jihadist group, Al-Shabaab, and went to school and, you know, kind of knew them from the community and knew other ones as well.
I'm curious, what is that like for an immigrant community like the Somalis here in the U.S. to have its young members leave, disappear, go somewhere where their end could, you know, frankly, be pretty brutal?
I think that goes back to the original issue, the kind of the root cause, the source of where this all started up. It's a sense of belonging, it's identity crisis, and there's this group that are reaching for them that's somehow indoctrinating them, telling them that you belong here. Their mission statement somehow seems to be somewhat attractive. Good number of the ones that left back have been previous members of gang here in Minnesota. So that kind of tells you the trend or who they look to outreach to once they get tired of that gang and street life and being homeless and being the violent, and they go to the mosque, then they have someone who tells them the afterlife is better, but there are conditions that comes to reach that point, and somehow they set this appealing goal to them.
What about those two young recruits whom you knew in high school? I mean, does this kind of description scan for them as well? Identity crisis?
I interviewed them in my radio show, I think a few months before he left to Somalia. In that interview, and I kind of go back and listen to it, and I just hear him echo how much lost he was, and kind of really breaks my heart just to know that, and he's dead now, but just to know that so many young lives are lost to gangs and to terrorist groups just because, you know, they're lost and they don't have great role models or, you know, a terror group that's saying, come, we'll give you a home, we'll accept you.
Tell me briefly about your own time in the Twin Cities, Zohor. How did you get there, and has assimilation ever been difficult for you?
I've left Somalia right shortly after the Civil War, migrated to Syria, then to here, came here when I was 13. So it's a struggle, whether, you know, you're young or old, but it's a identity in who I am. And it even became a bigger question when I went back home in 2011 and realized that I'm not as 100% of a Somali as I thought I am.
Zohor Ahmed is a Somali-American resident of the Twin Cities and currently works as a community health worker there. Zohor, great to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now to another immigrant community, this one in Maine. The state's become home to a small but growing population of South Asians. Maine Public Radio's Patty White brings us a story of how one Hindu community is establishing its ethnic and religious roots there.
Except from the sign outside, you wouldn't likely suspect that the old Universalist church in a suburb of Portland, Maine, is now a Hindu temple. It's still got that classic New England church look with its white wooden clapboards. But step inside and see a space recently transformed by colorful streamers and garlands, portraits of Hindu gods, and music. It's the last day of a week-long celebration honoring Lord Ganesha, a Hindu deity. And Devin Bhatt, the president of the temple, says it's a fitting festival for the community.
Lord Ganesha is considered the remover of obstacles, and God knows we have had so many obstacles in our way.
It's because Maine's Hindu population isn't that big. There are only estimates of its size, from several hundred families to a couple thousand Hindus. But it's growing, and now Bhatt says the community's finally managed to establish its first public temple.
If you are in a bigger city, there is power in numbers. Here, because of the small community, the affordability, like how do you buy and do that?
It used to be that Hindus here would drive hours out of state to go to temple, or they'd hold celebrations in their homes. It was clear that a communal space in Maine was needed. So last December, when members spotted the old vacant Universalist church, they snapped it up. Bhatt says the place felt right.
I think the first feeling that comes to my heart, I feel it's very peaceful, the vibrations that I believe of the place that has been place of worship for 100+ years.
To buy the church, the community needed to raise an extra $40,000. They collected that cash in just 10 days. Now, volunteers oversee the temple. On a recent afternoon, I met with Nagina Sawant. She rolls out mats in front of an altar for Lord Ganesha. Though she's a busy mom and doesn't drive, she finds rides or takes a bus to temple to clean and prepare for festivals.
We wanted a place to worship. We wanted a place where our children can all come together, worship, socialize, culture, enhance their knowledge, you know, because otherwise we had to go all the way to Massachusetts to visit gods and to pray and to worship and to enjoy festivals.
So now, Maine offers a space to worship on top of what already draws many Hindus to the state, good jobs and quality of life. Krishan Verma came to Maine 25 years ago for college, became a psychiatrist, and never left. He and his wife Rashmi remember when they only had a few Hindu friends here.
Community was very small, and they used to have a group get together at their place in Harrison, I believe.
25 people, hardly.
Right, hardly.
Yeah, and now we have big, huge community, I will say, comparison to what we used to have.
Temple president Devin Bhatt came to Maine for an IT job, like many other Indians after the tech boom. Though he's only been in Maine for a couple years, he's lived in the U.S. for almost 30. He says that being part of the smaller, tight-knit Hindu community here has actually allowed him to rediscover his cultural identity.
I have done more kirtans and chanting here in 3.5 years than I ever did in my entire life.
Bhatt says he hopes the new Maine Hindu Temple, as it's called, will foster further growth in the local Hindu community. They've already opened their doors to other faiths and curious passersby.
We had a few people who walk in like, hey, I just saw the sign and I didn't know that this place existed here and I know about this and I practice this and can I come? And it just gives me so much joy.
Bhatt tells me that he once feared losing his Hindu culture in the U.S. Now he says he's not afraid of that anymore. For The World, I'm Patty White in Portland, Maine.
Patty's story is part of our ongoing Global Nation coverage about a changing America and its people. You can join the Global Nation conversation. Tweet us at PRI Global Nation. We have a quick update now on a story we told you about last week. You might recall the case of the missing pony in Italy, a little miniature horse named Charlie. He'd been kidnapped from his stall at a horse show in the central Umbria region. Charlie's pretty famous, actually. At just over 24 inches, he's billed by his owner as the smallest horse in the world. Not sure that's officially recognized by anyone, but yeah, that's one tiny horse. Police thought the horse nappers might be looking for a ransom payment. Well, here's the update, and it's good news. Charlie's owner says the perps did ask him for a 10,000 euro ransom, but he refused. Instead, Bartolo Messina appealed to the criminal's softer side. That's Bartolo a few days ago asking the thieves to have a heart and remember that Charlie's not just an animal, but a member of his family. Well, maybe that did the trick, because a few days later, Charlie was found tied to a tree near the southern shores of Lake Garda, about 200 miles north of the spot where he'd vanished from. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Back now to the story of the Nairobi Mall attacks. Kenyan officials say the siege is now over. The massive emergency response, with ambulances, triage centers, and blood drives, is giving way to missing persons registries and counseling for victims. It's all been coordinated by Kenya's Red Cross, using medical personnel, trained volunteers, and increasingly social media. Reporter Valerie Hamilton explains.
When the first reports of shooting at Nairobi's Westgate Mall came in, Philip Agola jumped to action. He tweeted it. Warning, avoid Westgate Mall in Westlands. Heavy shootout reported. Red Cross ambulance at scene. Agola runs the Kenya Red Cross's social media command center from a cluster of computer screens at Red Cross headquarters in Nairobi. Earlier this month, before the attacks, he gave me a tour. Since last year, Kenya Red Cross has been using social media like a virtual 911, taking in information about emergencies and putting out public safety information 24 hours a day.
The information I get online is amazing. You actually get the exact location of where the incident is. You get photos, how many people are injured, where, how far, as in, it's amazing. Because previously it was really hard.
Agola says he's helped coordinate response to hundreds of emergencies, liaising with social media users on the scene and emergency services all over the country, all with the help of ordinary Kenyans on their mobile phones.
So Kenyans thought, I can actually save someone's life with a touch of the button. And it went viral.
Here's how it works. Let's say you see an accident, a shooting, or a fire. You tweet or Facebook or text Kenya Red Cross. Agola searches social media for photos or other information on the same incident. Within minutes, he forwards it all to first responders on the ground, medics, firefighters, or the police. For Kenya, this is new.
We never had any reporting tool in Kenya.
Kenya's public emergency services are notoriously threadbare. There's no national 911 type number for medical crises and no working national disaster plan. But thousands of Kenyans are plugged in to Red Cross social media through their mobile phones and tweet-to-text services. Often, the Red Cross is their first call.
Hey, plus, good afternoon.
Joanne Gitao dispatches ambulances for Red Cross EMTs.
Even the government sometimes falls back on us instead of them having their own systems in place.
The terror attack on the Westgate Mall was Kenya's biggest crisis since the 1998 embassy bombings. Red Cross and social media have been on the front lines. Over Skype this morning, Philip Agola told me about people who were trapped inside, tweeting the Red Cross for help.
I was getting tweets from guys in the basement parking. I was getting tweets from injured, getting tweets of guys who were hiding in the building. I have no words. I totally have no words.
Agola set up a hashtag, Red Cross Trace, to help match tweets from inside Westgate with worried loved ones outside. From his iPad at the triage station outside the mall, he put out updates about casualties, first aid, missing persons, and counseling services, and helped organize an unprecedented nationwide blood drive. Today, Twitter is buzzing with posts calling him a hero. He says he couldn't have done it without social media.
It would have been totally impossible to comprehend the situation on the ground, to know the needs of the people, to actually even publish information of what you need on the ground, because it was easy for me to tweet and say, hey guys, we need syringes, we need gauzes, we need this, we need water.
Kenya Red Cross has more than 100,000 followers on Twitter and 26,000 on Facebook. On a normal day, Agola says his posts and reposts reach 5 million people. Since the Westgate attack, he says they've gone viral, reaching 50 million people around the globe. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton.
The scene of the terrorist attack and siege in Nairobi, the Westgate Mall, is in an upscale part of the city. Across town is Kibera, a slum that's home to around a quarter of a million people. And to get the latest news, residents there listen to this.
Unasikiliza Pamoja FM.
Pamoja FM is a community radio station. Kamadi Amata is a DJ at Pamoja FM in Kibera. Kamadi, thanks very much for joining us. On your radio station there, how have you been talking about this attack at the Westgate Mall? Do you have any reporters there?
Yeah, we had a reporter there at the Westgate scene where the attack occurred. I was there on Sunday, the whole day from morning to evening.
Kamadi, you're a DJ, right? You play music. That's something that DJs typically do without even thinking about it. But are you finding that you have to select your music more carefully, especially in the past few days?
Yeah, we have to select music so that it makes people to feel that they are patriotic. It is sending a message of condolences. In that of condolences, we take the music, for example, that of Remy Ongala, the song called Kifo. So the song tried to describe that, death has taken away my father, it has taken away my mother, my aunt, my uncle, my grandmother, everybody. So it has left me alone.
Kifo!
The
wengine wana mipele, wengine wana ukurutu, wengine wameza watoto wamekufa.
So you do a drive time radio program. What are your listeners saying about what's been happening at Westgate?
Most of my listeners have been talking about Kenya needs to up their game in security in most part of the country, in borders, in airports, in seaports, and all over the country. Because like one person, a listener was saying, if they can attack a building at the capital center, why not in the other small center?
I know you're the moderator of those discussions with your listeners, Kamadi, but how has this tragedy affected you personally?
Yeah, it has affected me once. I'm also a Kenyan. I feel bad to have lost my countrymen. Now I have to work extra hard trying to convince those ones that have lost their loved ones that we are still together.
By the way, what does pamoja mean?
It's a Swahili word which means togetherness.
Kamadi Amata is a DJ at Pamoja FM in the giant slum in Nairobi known as Kibera. Kamadi, keep up the good work for your listeners. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Pini akali tumboni kifo mchukua mke wangu mwanangu analia kila siku baba mama yupo wapi nashindwa la kusema machozi yananitoka shauri yako wewe kifo 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 akina huruma
Music from the great Remy Ongala closes our program today. Tip of the hat to Pamoja FM in Nairobi for that one. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
Lakini kifo we, kwa nini hauna huruma?
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.
PRI, Public Radio International.